of students from his marketing research class. On this day, Drazen, George Lowenstein, a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and I would have an unusual request for this group of future marketing pros. We would ask them to jot down the last two digits of their social security numbers and tell us whether they would pay this amount for a number of products, including the bottle of wine. Then we would ask them to actually bid on these items in an auction. What were we trying to prove? The existence of what we call arbitrary coherence. The basic idea of arbitrary coherence is this. Although initial prices, such as the price of Asael's pearls, are arbitrary, once those prices are established in our minds, they will shape not only present prices, but also future prices. This makes them coherent. So would thinking about one's social security number be enough to create an anchor? That's what we wanted to see. For those of you who don't know much about wines, Drazen continued, this bottle received 86 points from Wine Spectator. It has the flavour of red berry, mocha, and black chocolate. It's a medium-bodied, medium-intensity, nicely balanced red, and it makes for delightful drinking. Drazen held up another bottle. This was a Hermitage Jaboulet-la-Chapelle 1996, with a 92-point rating from Wine Advocate magazine. The finest La Chapelle since 1990, Drazen intoned, while the students looked up curiously. Only 8,100 cases made. In turn, Drazen held up four other items. A cordless trackball, Trackman Marble FX by Logitech, a cordless keyboard and mouse, iTouch by Logitech, a design book, The Perfect Package, How to Add Value Through Graphic Design, and a £1 box of Belgian chocolates by Newhouse. Drazen passed out forms that listed all the items. Now I want you to write the last two digits of your social security number at the top of the page, he instructed, and then write them again next to each of the items in the form of a price. In other words, if the last two digits are 23, write $23. Now when you're finished with that, he added, I want you to indicate on your sheets, with a simple yes or no, whether you would pay that amount for each of the products. When the students had finished answering yes or no to each item, Drazen asked them to write down the maximum amount they were willing to pay for each of the products, their bids. Once they had written down their bids, the students passed the sheets up to me, and I entered their responses into my laptop and announced the winners. One by one, the student who had made the highest bid for each of the products would step up to the front of the class, pay for the product, and take it with them. The price the highest bidder paid for an item was based not on his own bid, but on that of the second highest bidder. This is called a second price auction. William Vickrey received the Nobel Prize in Economics for demonstrating that this type of auction creates the conditions where it is in people's best interest to bid the maximum amount they are willing to pay for each item. This is also the general logic behind the auction system on eBay. The students enjoyed this class exercise, but when I asked them if they felt that writing down the last two digits of their social security numbers had influenced their final bids, they quickly dismissed my suggestion. No way. When I got back to my office, I analyzed the data. Did the digits from the social security numbers serve as anchors? Remarkably, they did. The students with the highest ending social security digits, from 80 to 99, bid highest, while those with the lowest ending numbers, 1 to 20, bid lowest. The top 20%, for instance, bid an average of $56 for the cordless keyboard. The bottom 20% bid an average of $16. In the end, we could see that students with social security numbers ending in the upper 20% placed bids that were 216 to 346% higher than those of the students with social security numbers ending in the lowest 20%. Now, if the last two digits of your social security number are a high number, I know what you must be thinking. I've been paying too much for everything my entire life. This is not the case, however. Social security numbers were the anchor in this experiment only because we requested them. We could have just as well asked for the current temperature or the manufacturer's suggested retail price, MSRP. Any question, in fact, would have created the anchor. Does that seem rational? Of course not. But that's the way we are. Goslings, after all. When I've tried this kind of experiment on executives and managers at the MIT Executive Education Program, I've had similar success making their social security numbers influence the prices they were willing to pay for chocolates, books, and other products. The data had one more interesting aspect. Although the willingness to pay for these items was arbitrary, there was also a logical, coherent aspect to it. When we looked at the bids for the two pairs of related items, the two wines and the two computer components, their relative prices seemed incredibly logical. Everyone was willing to pay more for the keyboard than for the trackball, and also pay more for the 1996 Hermitage than for the 1998 Côte du Rhône. The significance of this is that once the participants were willing to pay a certain price for one product, their willingness to pay for other items in the same product category was judged relative to that first price, the anchor. This, then, is what we call arbitrary coherence. Initial prices are largely arbitrary and can be influenced by responses to random questions, but once those prices are established in our minds, they shape not only what we are willing to pay for an item, but also how much we are willing to pay for related products. This makes them coherent. Now I need to add one important clarification to the story I've just told. In life, we are bombarded by prices. We see the manufacturer's suggested retail price, MSRP, for cars, lawnmowers, and coffee makers. We get the real estate agent's spiel on local housing prices. But price tags by themselves are not necessarily anchors. They become anchors when we contemplate buying a product or service at that particular price. That's when the imprint is set. From then on, we are willing to accept a range of prices. But as with the pull of a bungee cord, we always refer back to the original anchor. Thus, the first anchor influences not only the immediate buying decision, but many others that follow. We might see a 52-inch LCD high-definition television on sale for $3,000, for instance. The price tag is not the anchor. But if we decide to buy it, or seriously contemplate buying it, at that price, then the decision becomes our anchor henceforth, in terms of LCD television sets. That's our peg in the ground. And from then on, whether we shop for another set or merely have a conversation at a backyard cookout, all other high-definition televisions are judged relative to that price. Anchoring influences all kinds of purchases. Yuri Simonson, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and George Lowenstein, for example, found that people who move to a new city generally remain anchored to the prices they paid for housing in their former city. In their study, they found that people who move from inexpensive markets, say, Lubbock, Texas, to moderately priced cities, say, Pittsburgh, don't increase their spending to fit the new market. The result was not due to wealth, taxes, or other financial reasons. Rather, these people spend an amount similar to what they were used to in the previous market, even if this means having to squeeze themselves and their families into smaller or less comfortable homes. Likewise, transplants from more expensive cities sink the same dollars into their new housing situation as they did in the past. People who move from Los Angeles to Pittsburgh, in other words, don't generally downsize their spending much once they hit Pennsylvania. They spend an amount similar to what they used to spend in Los Angeles. It seems that we get used to the particularities of our housing markets and don't readily change. The only way out of this box, in fact, is to rent a home in the new location for a year or so. That way, we adjust to the new environment, and after a while, we are able to make a purchase that aligns with the local market. So we anchor ourselves to initial prices. But do we hop from one anchor price to another, flip-flopping, if you will, continually changing our willingness to pay? Or does the first anchor we encounter become our anchor for a long time and for many decisions? To answer this question, we decided to conduct another experiment, one in which we attempted to lure our participants from old anchors to new ones. For this experiment, we enlisted some undergraduate students, some graduate students, and some investment bankers who had come to the campus to recruit new employees for their firms. Once the experiment started, we presented our participants with three different sounds, and following each, asked them if they would be willing to get paid a particular amount of money which served as the price anchor, for hearing those sounds again. One sound was a 30-second high-pitched 3,000 hertz sound, somewhat like someone screaming in a high-pitched voice. Another was a 30-second full-spectrum noise, also called white noise, which is similar to the noise a television set makes when there is no reception. The third was a 30-second oscillation between high-pitched and low-pitched sounds. I'm not sure if the bankers understood exactly what they were about to experience, but maybe even our annoying sounds were less annoying than talking about investment banking. We used sounds because there is no existing market for annoying sounds, so the participants couldn't use a market price as a way to think about the value of these sounds. We used annoying sounds, specifically, because no one likes such sounds. If we had used classical music, some would have liked it better than others. As for the sounds themselves, I selected them after creating hundreds of sounds, choosing these three because they were, in my opinion, equally annoying. We placed our participants in front of computer screens at the lab and had them clamp headphones over their ears. As the room quieted down, the first group saw this message appear in front of them. In a few moments, we are going to play a new unpleasant tone over your headset. We are interested in how annoying you find it. Immediately, after you hear the tone, we will ask you whether, hypothetically, you would be willing to repeat the same experience in exchange for a payment of 10 cents. The second group got the same message, only with an offer of 90 cents rather than 10 cents. Would the anchor prices make a difference? To find out, we turned on the sound. In this case, the irritating 30-second 3,000 hertz squeal. Some of our participants grimaced, others rolled their eyes. When the screeching ended, each participant was presented with the anchor in question, phrased as a hypothetical choice. Would the participant be willing, hypothetically, to repeat the experience for a cash payment, which was 10 cents for the first group and 90 cents for the second group? After answering this anchoring question, the participants were asked to indicate on the computer screen the lowest price they would demand to listen to the sound again. This decision was real, by the way, as it would determine whether they would hear the sound again and get paid for doing so. To ensure that the bids we got were indeed the lowest prices for which the participants would listen to the annoying sounds, we used the Becker de Groot Marshak procedure. This is an auction-like procedure in which each of the participants bids against a price randomly drawn by a computer. Soon after the participants entered their prices, they learned the outcome. Participants whose price was sufficiently low won the sound, had the unpleasant opportunity to hear it again, and got paid for doing so. The participants whose price was too high did not listen to the sound and were not paid for this part of the experiment. What was the point of all this? We wanted to find out whether the first prices that we suggested, 10 cents and 90 cents, had served as an anchor. And indeed they had. Those who first faced the hypothetical decision about whether to listen to the sound for 10 cents needed much less money to be willing to listen to this sound again, 33 cents on average, relative to those who first faced the hypothetical decision about whether to listen to the sound for 90 cents. This second group demanded more than twice the compensation, 73 cents on average, for the same annoying experience. Do you see the difference that the suggested price had? But this was only the start of our exploration. We also wanted to know how influential the anchor would be in future decisions. Suppose we gave the participants an opportunity to drop this anchor and run for another. Would they do it? To put it in terms of goslings, would they swim across the pond after their original imprint and then midway swing their allegiance to a new mother goose? In terms of goslings, I think you know that they would stick with the original mum. But what about humans? The next two phases of the experiment would enable us to answer these questions. In the second phase of the experiment, we took participants from the previous 10-cent and 90-cent groups and treated them to 30 seconds of a white whooshing noise. Hypothetically, would you listen to this sound again for 50 cents? We asked them at the end. The respondents pressed a button on their computers to indicate yes or no. Okay. How much would you need to be paid for this? We asked. Our participants typed in their lowest price. The computer did its thing, and depending on their bids, some participants listened to the sound again and got paid, and some did not. When we compared the prices, the 10 cents group offered much lower bids than the 90 cents group. This means that although both groups had been equally exposed to the suggested 50 cents as their focal anchoring response to, hypothetically, would you listen to this sound again for 50 cents, the first anchor in this annoying sound category, which was 10 cents for some and 90 cents for others, predominated. Why? Perhaps the participants in the 10 cents group said something like the following to themselves. Well, I listened previously to that annoying sound for a low amount. This sound is not much different, so if I said a low amount for the previous one, I guess I could bear this sound for about the same price. Those who were in the 90 cents group used the same type of logic, but because their starting point was different, so was their ending point. These individuals told themselves, well, I listened previously to that annoying sound for a high amount. This sound is not much different, so since I said a high amount for the previous one, I guess I could bear this sound for about the same price. Indeed, the effect of the first anchor held, indicating that anchors have an enduring effect for present prices as well as for future prices. There was one more step to this experiment. This time, we had our participants listen to the oscillating sound that rose and fell in pitch for 30 seconds. We asked our 10 cents group, hypothetically, would you listen to this sound again for 90 cents? Then we asked our 90 cents group, would you listen to this sound again for 10 cents? Having flipped our anchors, we would now see which one exerted the greatest influence. Once again, the participants typed in yes or no. Then we asked them for real bids. How much would it take for you to listen to this again? At this point, they had a history with 3 anchors. The first one they encountered in the experiment, either 10 cents or 90 cents, the second one, 50 cents, and the most recent one, either 90 cents or 10 cents. Which one of these would have the largest influence on the price they demanded to listen to the sound? Again, it was as if our participants' minds told them, if I listen to the first sound for X cents, and listen to the second sound for X cents as well, then I can surely do this one for X cents too. And that's what they did. Those who had first encountered the 10 cent anchor accepted low prices, even after 90 cents were suggested as the anchor. On the other hand, those who had first encountered the 90 cent anchor kept on demanding much higher prices, regardless of the anchors that followed. What did we show? That our first decisions resonate over a long sequence of decisions. First impressions are important, whether they involve remembering that our first DVD player cost much more than such players cost today, and realizing that in comparison the current prices are a steal, or remembering that gas was once $1 a gallon, which makes every trip to the gas station a painful experience. In all these cases, the random and not so random anchors that we encountered along the way, and were swayed by, remain with us long after the initial decision itself. Now that we know we behave like goslings, it is important to understand the process by which our first decisions translate into long-term habits. To illustrate this process, consider this example. You're walking past a restaurant, and you see 2 people standing in line waiting to get in. This must be a good restaurant, you think to yourself. People are standing in line. So you stand behind these people. Another person walks by. He sees 3 people standing in line and thinks, this must be a fantastic restaurant, and joins the line. Others join. We call this type of behavior herding. It happens when we assume that something is good or bad on the basis of other people's previous behavior, and our own actions follow suit. But there's also another kind of herding, one that we call self-herding. This happens when we believe something is good or bad on the basis of our own previous behavior. Essentially, once we become the first person in line at the restaurant, we begin to line up behind ourselves in subsequent experiences. Does that make sense? Let me explain. Recall your first introduction to Starbucks, perhaps several years ago. I assume that nearly everyone has had this experience, since Starbucks sits on every corner in America. You are sleepy and in desperate need of a liquid energy boost, as you embark on an errand one afternoon. You glance through the windows at Starbucks and walk in. The prices of the coffee are a shock. You've been blissfully drinking the brew at Dunkin' Donuts for years. But since you have walked in and are now curious about what coffee at this price might taste like, you surprise yourself. You buy a small coffee, enjoy its taste and its effect on you, and walk out. The following week, you walk by Starbucks again. Should you go in? The ideal decision-making process should take into account the quality of the coffee, Starbucks versus Dunkin' Donuts, the prices at the two places, and, of course, the cost, or value, of walking a few more blocks to get to Dunkin' Donuts. This is a complex computation, so instead you resort to the simple approach. I went to Starbucks before, and I enjoyed myself and the coffee, so this must be a good decision for me. So you walk in and get another small cup of coffee. In doing so, you just became the second person in line, standing behind yourself. A few days later, you again walk by Starbucks, and this time, you vividly remember your past decisions and act on them again. Voila! You become the third person in line, standing behind yourself. As the weeks pass, you enter again and again, and every time you feel more strongly that you are acting on the basis of your preferences. Buying coffee at Starbucks has become a habit with you. But the story doesn't end there. Now that you have gotten used to paying more for coffee and have bumped yourself up onto a new curve of consumption, other changes also become simpler. Perhaps you will now move up from the small cup for $2.20 to the medium size for $3.50, or to the venti for $4.15. Even though you don't know how you got into this price bracket in the first place, moving to a larger coffee at a relatively greater price seems pretty logical. So is a lateral move to other offerings at Starbucks. Café Americano, Café Misto, Macchiato, and Frappuccino, for instance. If you stopped to think about this, it would not be clear whether you should be spending all this money on coffee at Starbucks instead of getting cheaper coffee at Dunkin' Donuts or even free coffee at the office. But you don't think about these trade-offs anymore. You've already made this decision many times in the past, so you now assume that this is the way you want to spend your money. You've herded yourself, lining up behind your initial experience at Starbucks, and now you're part of the crowd. There is something odd in this story. If anchoring is based on our initial decisions, how did Starbucks manage to become an initial decision in the first place? In other words, if we were previously anchored to Dunkin' Donuts prices, how did we move our anchor to Starbucks? This is where it gets really interesting. When Howard Schultz created Starbucks, he was as intuitive a businessman as Salvador Azzael. He worked diligently to separate Starbucks from other coffee shops, not through price, but through ambience. Accordingly, he designed Starbucks from the very beginning to feel like a continental coffee house. The early shops were fragrant with the smell of roasted beans, and better quality roasted beans than those at Dunkin' Donuts. They sold fancy French coffee presses. The showcases presented alluring snacks, almond croissants, biscotti, raspberry custard pastries, and others. Whereas Dunkin' Donuts had small, medium, and large coffees, Starbucks offered short, tall, grande, and venti, as well as drinks with high pedigree names like Café Americano, Café Misto, Macchiato, and Frappuccino. Starbucks did everything in its power, in other words, to make the experience feel different. So different that we would not use the prices at Dunkin' Donuts as an anchor, but instead would be open to the new anchor that Starbucks was preparing for us. And that, to a great extent, is how Starbucks succeeded. George, Drazen, and I were so excited with the experiments on coherent arbitrariness that we decided to push the idea one step farther. This time, we had a different twist to explore. Do you remember the famous episode in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, the one in which Tom turns the whitewashing of Aunt Polly's fence into an exercise in manipulating his friends? As I'm sure you recall, Tom applies the paint with gusto, pretending to enjoy the job. "Do you call this work?" Tom tells his friends. "Does a boy get a chance to whitewash a fence every day?" Armed with this new information, his friends discover the joys of whitewashing a fence. Before long, Tom's friends were not only paying him for the privilege, but deriving real pleasure from the task. A win-win outcome, if there ever was one. From our perspective, Tom transformed a negative experience to a positive one. He transformed a situation in which compensation was required to one in which people, Tom's friends, would pay to get in on the fun. Could we do the same? We thought we'd give it a try. One day, to the surprise of my students, I opened the day's lecture on managerial psychology with a poetry selection. A few lines of "Whoever You Are Holding Me Now in Hand" from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. "Whoever you are holding me now in hand, without one thing all will be useless. I give you fair warning before you attempt me further. I am not what you supposed, but far different. Who is he that would become my follower? Who would sign himself a candidate for my affections? The way is suspicious, the result uncertain, perhaps destructive. You would have to give up all else. I alone would expect to be your sole and exclusive standard. Your novitiate would even then be long and exhausting. The whole past theory of your life and all conformity to the lives around you would have to be abandoned. Therefore release me now before troubling yourself any further. Let go your hand from my shoulders. Put me down and depart on your way." After closing the book, I told the students that I would be conducting three readings from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass that Friday evening. One short, one medium, and one long. Owing to limited space, I told them, I had decided to hold an auction to determine who could attend. I passed out sheets of paper so that they could bid for a space, but before they did so, I had a question to ask them. I asked half the students to write down whether, hypothetically, they would be willing to pay me $10 for a 10-minute recitation. I asked the other half to write down whether, hypothetically, they would be willing to listen to me recite poetry for 10 minutes if I paid them $10. This, of course, served as the anchor. Now I asked the students to bid for a spot at my poetry reading. Do you think the initial anchor influenced the ensuing bids? Before I tell you, consider two things. First, my skills at reading poetry are not of the first order, so asking someone to pay me for 10 minutes of it could be considered a stretch. Second, even though I asked the students if they would pay me for the privilege of attending the recitation, they didn't have to bid that way. They could have turned the tables completely and demanded that I pay them. And now to the results. Drum roll, please. Those who answered the hypothetical question about paying me were indeed willing to pay me for the privilege. They offered, on average, to pay me about $1 for the short poetry reading, about $2 for the medium poetry reading, and a bit more than $3 for the long poetry reading. Maybe I could make a living outside academe after all. But what about those who were anchored to the thought of being paid rather than paying me? As you might expect, they demanded payment. On average, they wanted $1.30 to listen to the short poetry reading, $2.70 to listen to the medium poetry reading, and $4.80 to endure the long poetry reading. Much like Tom Sawyer, then, I was able to take an ambiguous experience, and if you could hear me recite poetry, you would understand just how ambiguous this experience is, and arbitrarily make it into a pleasurable or painful experience. Neither group of students knew whether my poetry reading was of the quality that is worth paying for, or of the quality that is worth listening to only if one is being financially compensated for the experience. They did not know if it is pleasurable or painful. But once the first impression had been formed, that they would pay me, or that I would pay them, the die was cast, and the anchor set. Moreover, once the first decision had been made, other decisions followed in what seemed to be a logical and coherent manner. The students did not know whether listening to me recite poetry was a good or bad experience, but whatever their first decision was, they used it as input for their next decisions, and provided a coherent pattern of responses across the three poetry readings. Of course, Mark Twain came to the same conclusions. "If Tom had been a great and wise philosopher, like the writer of this book, he would now have comprehended that work consists of whatever a body is obliged to do, and that play consists of whatever a body is not obliged to do." Mark Twain further observed, There are wealthy gentlemen in England who drive 4-horse passenger coaches 20 or 30 miles on a daily line in the summer because the privilege costs them considerable money. But if they were offered wages for the service, that would turn it into work, and then they would resign. We will return to this astute observation in the chapter on social and market norms, chapter 4. Where do these thoughts lead us? For one, they illustrate the many choices we make, from the trivial to the profound, in which anchoring plays a role. We decide whether or not to purchase Big Macs, smoke, run red lights, take vacations in Patagonia, listen to Tchaikovsky, slave away at doctoral dissertations, marry, have children, live in the suburbs, vote Republican, and so on. According to economic theory, we base these decisions on our fundamental values, our likes and dislikes. But what are the main lessons from these experiments about our lives in general? Could it be that the lives we have so carefully crafted are largely just a product of arbitrary coherence? Could it be that we made arbitrary decisions at some point in the past, like the Goslings who adopted Lorenz as their parent, and have built our lives on them ever since, assuming that the original decisions were wise? Is that how we chose our careers, our spouses, the clothes we wear, and the way we style our hair? Were they smart decisions in the first place? Or were they partially random first imprints that have run wild? Descartes said, "Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am." But suppose we are nothing more than the sum of our first, naive, random behaviours. What then? These questions may be tough nuts to crack, but in terms of our personal lives, we can actively improve on our irrational behaviours. We can start by becoming aware of our vulnerabilities. Suppose you're planning to buy a cutting-edge cell phone, the one with the 3-megapixel, 8x zoom digital camera, or even a daily $4 cup of gourmet coffee. You might begin by questioning that habit. How did it begin? Second, ask yourself what amount of pleasure you will be getting out of it. Is the pleasure as much as you thought you would get? Could you cut back a little and spend the remaining money better on something else? With everything you do, in fact, you should train yourself to question your repeated behaviours. In the case of the cell phone, could you take a step back from the cutting edge, reduce your outlay, and use some of the money for something else? And as for the coffee, rather than asking which blend of coffee you will have today, ask yourself whether you should even be having that habitual cup of expensive coffee at all. I am not claiming that spending money on a wonderful cup of coffee every day, or even a few times a day, is necessarily a bad decision. I am saying only that we should question our decisions. We should also pay particular attention to the first decision we make in what is going to be a long stream of decisions, about clothing, food, etc. When we face such a decision, it might seem to us that this is just one decision, without large consequences. But in fact, the power of the first decision can have such a long-lasting effect that it will percolate into our future decisions for years to come. Given this effect, the first decision is crucial, and we should give it an appropriate amount of attention. Socrates said that the unexamined life is not worth living. Perhaps it's time to inventory the imprints and anchors in our own life. Even if they once were completely reasonable, are they still reasonable? Once the old choices are reconsidered, we can open ourselves to new decisions and the new opportunities of a new day. That seems to make sense. All this talk about anchors and Goslings has larger implications than consumer preferences, however. Traditional economics assumes that prices of products in the market are determined by a balance between two forces: production at each price, supply, and the desires of those with purchasing power at each price, demand. The price at which these two forces meet determines the prices in the marketplace. This is an elegant idea, but it depends centrally on the assumption that the two forces are independent and that together they produce the market price. The results of all the experiments presented in this chapter, and the basic idea of arbitrary coherence itself, challenge these assumptions. First, according to the standard economic framework, consumers' willingness to pay is one of the two inputs that determine market prices. This is the demand. But as our experiments demonstrate, what consumers are willing to pay can easily be manipulated. And this means that consumers don't in fact have a good handle on their own preferences and the prices they are willing to pay for different goods and experiences. Second, whereas the standard economic framework assumes that the forces of supply and demand are independent, the type of anchoring manipulations we have shown here suggests that they are in fact dependent. In the real world, anchoring comes from manufacturer-suggested retail prices, MSRPs, advertised prices, promotions, product introductions, etc., all of which are supply-side variables. It seems, then, that instead of consumers' willingness to pay influencing market prices, the causality is somewhat reversed, and it is market prices themselves that influence consumers' willingness to pay. What this means is that demand is not, in fact, a completely separate force from supply. And this is not the end of the story. In the framework of arbitrary coherence, the relationships we see in the marketplace between demand and supply, for example, buying more yogurt when it is discounted, are based not on preferences, but on memory. Here is an illustration of this idea. Consider your current consumption of milk and wine. Now imagine that two new taxes will be introduced tomorrow. One will cut the price of wine by 50%, and the other will increase the price of milk by 100%. What do you think will happen? These price changes will surely affect consumption, and many people will walk around slightly happier and with less calcium. But now imagine this. What if the new taxes are accompanied by induced amnesia for the previous prices of wine and milk? What if the prices change in the same way, but you do not remember what you paid for these two products in the past? I suspect that the price changes would make a huge impact on demand if people remembered the previous prices and noticed the price increases, but I also suspect that without a memory for past prices, these price changes would have a trivial effect, if any, on demand. If people had no memory of past prices, the consumption of milk and wine would remain essentially the same, as if the prices had not changed. In other words, the sensitivity we show to price changes might in fact be largely a result of our memory for the prices we have paid in the past and our desire for coherence with our past decisions, not at all a reflection of our true preferences or our level of demand. The same basic principle would also apply if the government one day decided to impose a tax that doubled the price of gasoline. Under conventional economic theory, this should cut demand. But would it? Certainly people would initially compare the new prices with their anchor, would be flabbergasted by the new prices, and so might pull back on their gasoline consumption, and maybe even get a hybrid car. But over the long run, and once consumers readjusted to the new price and the new anchors, just as we adjust to the price of Nike sneakers, bottled water, and everything else, our gasoline consumption at the new price might in fact get close to the pre-tax level. Moreover, much as in the example of Starbucks, this process of readjustment could be accelerated if the price change were to also be accompanied by other changes, such as a new grade of gas or a new type of fuel, such as corn-based ethanol fuel. I am not suggesting that doubling the price of gasoline would have no effect on consumers' demand, but I do believe that in the long term it would have a much smaller influence on demand than would be assumed from just observing the short-term market reactions to price increases. Another implication of arbitrary coherence has to do with the claimed benefits of the free market and free trade. The basic idea of the free market is that if I have something that you value more than I do, let's say a sofa, trading this item will benefit both of us. This means that the mutual benefit of trading rests on the assumption that all the players in the market know the value of what they have and the value of the things they are considering getting from the trade. But if our choices are often affected by random initial anchors, as we observed in our experiments, the choices and trades we make are not necessarily going to be an accurate reflection of the real pleasure or utility we derive from those products. In other words, in many cases, we make decisions in the marketplace that may not reflect how much pleasure we can get from different items. Now, if we can't accurately compute these pleasure values, but frequently follow arbitrary anchors instead, then it is not clear that the opportunity to trade is necessarily going to make us better off. For example, Because of some unfortunate initial anchors, we might mistakenly trade something that truly gives us a lot of pleasure, but regrettably had a low initial anchor, for something that gives us less pleasure, but owing to some random circumstances, had a high initial anchor. If anchors and memories of these anchors, but not preferences, determine our behaviour, why would trading be hailed as the key to maximising personal happiness? Utility. So where does this leave us? If we can't rely on the market forces of supply and demand to set optimal market prices, and we can't count on free market mechanisms to help us maximise our utility, then we may need to look elsewhere. This is especially the case with society's essentials, such as healthcare, medicine, water, electricity, education, and other critical resources. If you accept the premise that market forces and free markets will not always regulate the market for the best, then you may find yourself among those who believe that the government, we hope a reasonable and thoughtful government, must play a larger role in regulating some market activities, even if this limits free enterprise. Yes, a free market based on supply, demand, and no friction would be the ideal if we were truly rational. Yet, when we are not rational, but irrational, policies should take this important factor into account. Chapter 3. The Cost of Zero Cost. Why we often pay too much when we pay nothing. Have you ever grabbed for a coupon offering a free package of coffee beans, even though you don't drink coffee and don't even have a machine with which to brew it? What about all those free extra helpings you piled on your plate at a buffet, even though your stomach had already started to ache from all the food you had consumed? And what about the worthless free stuff you've accumulated? The promotional T-shirt from the radio station, the teddy bear that came with a box of Valentine chocolates, the magnetic calendar your insurance agent sends you each year. It's no secret that getting something free feels very good. Zero is not just another price, it turns out. Zero is an emotional hot button, a source of irrational excitement. Would you buy something if it were discounted from 50 cents to 20 cents? Maybe. Would you buy it if it were discounted from 50 cents to 2 cents? Maybe. Would you grab it if it were discounted from 50 cents to zero? You bet. What is it about zero cost that we find so irresistible? Why does free make us so happy? After all, free can lead us into trouble. Things that we would never consider purchasing become incredibly appealing as soon as they are free. For instance, have you ever gathered up free pencils, keychains, and notepads at a conference, even though you'd have to carry them home and would only throw most of them away? Have you ever stood in line for a very long time, too long, just to get a free cone of Ben and Jerry's ice cream? Or have you bought two of a product that you wouldn't have chosen in the first place, just to get the third one for free? Zero has had a long history. The Babylonians invented the concept of zero. The ancient Greeks debated it in lofty terms. How could something be nothing? The ancient Indian scholar Pingala paired zero with the numeral one to get double digits. And both the Mayans and the Romans made zero part of their numeral systems. But zero really found its place about AD 498, when the Indian astronomer Aryabhata sat up in bed one morning and exclaimed, "Satnam, Satnam, Dasa Gunam," which translates roughly as place to place in 10 times in value. With that, the idea of decimal-based place value notation was born. Now zero was on a roll. It spread to the Arab world, where it flourished, crossed the Iberian Peninsula to Europe, thanks to the Spanish Moors, got some tweaking from the Italians, and eventually sailed the Atlantic to the New World, where zero ultimately found plenty of employment, together with the digit one, in a place called Silicon Valley. So much for a brief recounting of the history of zero. But the concept of zero, applied to money, is less clearly understood. In fact, I don't think it even has a history. Nonetheless, free has huge implications, extending not only to discount prices and promotions, but also to how free can be used to help us make decisions that would benefit ourselves and society. If free were a virus or a subatomic particle, I might use an electron microscope to probe the object under the lens, stain it with different compounds to reveal its nature, or somehow slice it apart to reveal its inner composition. In behavioral economics, we use a different instrument, however. One that allows us to slow down human behavior and examine it frame by frame as it unfolds. As you have undoubtedly guessed by now, this procedure is called an experiment. In one experiment, Christina Champagnier, a PhD student at MIT, Nina Mazar, a professor at the University of Toronto, and I went into the chocolate business. Well, sort of. We set up a table at a large public building and offered two kinds of chocolates, Lindt truffles and Hershey's kisses. There was a large sign above our table that read, "One chocolate per customer." Once the potential customers stepped closer, they could see the two types of chocolate and their prices. We posted the prices so that they were visible only when people got close to the table. We did this because we wanted to make sure that we did not attract different types of people in the different conditions, avoiding what is called self-selection. For those of you who are not chocolate connoisseurs, Lindt is produced by a Swiss firm that has been blending fine cocoas for 160 years. Lindt's chocolate truffles are particularly prized, exquisitely creamy, and just about irresistible. They cost about 30 cents each when we buy them in bulk. Hershey's Kisses, on the other hand, are good little chocolates, but let's face it, they are rather ordinary. Hershey cranks out 80 million kisses a day. In Hershey, Pennsylvania, even the street lamps are made in the shape of the ubiquitous Hershey's Kiss. So what happened when the customers flocked to our table? When we set the price of a Lindt truffle at 15 cents and a kiss at 1 cent, we were not surprised to find that our customers acted with a good deal of rationality. They compared the price and quality of the kiss with the price and quality of the truffle, and then made their choice. About 73% of them chose the truffle, and 27% chose a kiss. Now we decided to see how free might change the situation. So we offered the Lindt truffle for 14 cents, and the kisses for free. Would there be a difference? Should there be? After all, we had merely lowered the price of both kinds of chocolate by 1 cent. But what a difference free made! The humble Hershey's Kiss became a big favorite. Some 69% of our customers, up from 27% before, chose the free kiss, giving up the opportunity to get the Lindt truffle for a very good price. Meanwhile, the Lindt truffle took a tumble. Customers choosing it decreased from 73 to 31%. What was going on here? First of all, let me say that there are many times when getting free items can make perfect sense. If you find a bin of free athletic socks at a department store, for instance, there's no downside to grabbing all the socks you can. The critical issue arises when free becomes a struggle between a free item and another item, a struggle in which the presence of free leads us to make a bad decision. For instance, imagine going to a sports store to buy a pair of white socks, the kind with a nicely padded heel and a gold toe. 15 minutes later, you're leaving the store, not with the socks you came in for, but with a cheaper pair that you don't like at all, without a padded heel and gold toe, but that came in a package with a free second pair. This is a case in which you gave up a better deal and settled for something that was not what you wanted, just because you were lured by the free. To replicate this experience in our chocolate experiment, we told our customers that they could choose only a single sweet, the kiss or the truffle. It was an either-or decision, like choosing one kind of athletic sock over another. That's what made the customer's reaction to the free kiss so dramatic. Both chocolates were discounted by the same amount of money. The relative price difference between the two was unchanged, and so was the expected pleasure from the two. According to standard economic theory, simple cost-benefit analysis, then, the price reduction should not lead to any change in the behavior of our customers. Before, about 27% chose the kiss, and 73% chose the truffle. And since nothing had changed in relative terms, the response to the price reduction should have been exactly the same. A passing economist, twirling his cane and espousing conventional economic theory, in fact, would have said that since everything in the situation was the same, our customers should have chosen the truffles by the same margin of preference. For a more detailed account of how a rational consumer should make decisions in these cases, listen to the appendix to this chapter. And yet here we were, with people pressing up to the table to grab our Hershey's Kisses, not because they had made a reasoned cost-benefit analysis before elbowing their way in, but simply because the kisses were free. How strange. but predictable. We humans are. This conclusion, incidentally, remained the same in other experiments as well. In one case, we priced the Hershey's Kiss at 2 cents, 1 cent, and 0 cents, while pricing the truffle correspondingly at 27 cents, 26 cents, and 25 cents. We did this to see if discounting the kiss from 2 cents to 1 cent and the truffle from 27 cents to 26 cents would make a difference in the proportion of buyers for each. It didn't. But once again, when we lowered the price of the kiss to free, the reaction was dramatic. The shoppers overwhelmingly demanded the kisses. We decided that perhaps the experiment had been tainted, since shoppers may not feel like searching for change in a purse or backpack, or they may not have any money on them. Such an effect would artificially make the free offer seem more attractive. To address this possibility, we ran other experiments at one of MIT's cafeterias. In this setup, the chocolates were displayed next to the cashier as one of the cafeteria's regular promotions, and the students, who were interested in the chocolates, simply added them to the lunch purchase and paid for them while going through the cashier's line. What happened? The students still went overwhelmingly for the free option. What is it about free that's so enticing? Why do we have an irrational urge to jump for a free item, even when it's not what we really want? I believe the answer is this. Most transactions have an upside and a downside. But when something is free, we forget the downside. Free gives us such an emotional charge that we perceive what is being offered as immensely more valuable than it really is. Why? I think it's because humans are intrinsically afraid of loss. The real allure of free is tied to this fear. There's no visible possibility of loss when we choose a free item. It's free. But suppose we choose the item that's not free. Uh-oh. Now there's a risk of having made a poor decision. The possibility of a loss. And so, given the choice, we go for what is free. For this reason, in the land of pricing, zero is not just another price. Sure, 10 cents can make a huge difference in demand. Suppose you were selling millions of barrels of oil, but nothing beats the emotional surge of free. This, the zero price effect, is in a category all its own. To be sure, buying something for nothing is a bit of an oxymoron. But let me give you an example of how we often fall into the trap of buying something we may not want simply because of that sticky substance. Free. I recently saw a newspaper ad from a major electronics maker offering me 7 free DVD titles if I purchased the maker's new high-definition DVD player. First of all, do I need a high-definition player right now? Probably not. But even if I did, wouldn't it be wiser to wait for prices to descend? They always do, and today's $600 high-definition DVD player will very quickly be tomorrow's $200 machine. Second, the DVD maker had a clear agenda behind its offer. This company's high-definition DVD system is in cutthroat competition with Blu-ray, a system backed by many other manufacturers. Right now, Blu-ray is ahead and could possibly dominate the market. So how much is free when the machine being offered may find its way into obsolescence, like Betamax VCRs? Those are two rational thoughts that might prevent us from falling under the spell of free. But gee, those free DVDs certainly look good. Getting something free is certainly a draw when we talk about prices. But what would happen if the offer was not a free price, but a free exchange? Are we as susceptible to free products as we are to getting products for free? A few years ago, with Halloween drawing near, I had an idea for an experiment to probe that question. This time, I wouldn't even have to leave my home to get my answers. Early in the evening, Joey, a 9-year-old kid dressed as a Spider-Man and carrying a large yellow bag, climbed the stairs of our front porch. His mother accompanied him to ensure that no one gave her kid an apple with a razor blade inside. By the way, there never was a case of razor blades being distributed in apples on Halloween. It is just an urban myth. She stayed on the sidewalk, however, to give Joey the feeling that he was trick-or-treating by himself. After the traditional query, trick-or-treat, I asked Joey to hold open his right hand. I placed 3 Hershey's Kisses in his palm and asked him to hold them there for a moment. "You can also get one of these 2 Snickers bars," I said, showing him a small one and a large one. "In fact, if you give me one of those Hershey's Kisses, I will give you this smaller Snickers bar. And if you give me 2 of your Hershey's Kisses, I will give you this larger Snickers bar." Now, a kid may dress up like a giant spider, but that doesn't mean he's stupid. The small Snickers bar weighed 1 ounce, and the large Snickers bar weighed 2 ounces. All Joey had to do was give me 1 additional Hershey's Kiss, about 0.16 of an ounce, and he would get an extra ounce of Snickers. This deal might have stumped a rocket scientist, but for a 9-year-old boy, the computation was easy. He'd get more than 6 times the return on investment in the net weight of chocolate if he went for the larger Snickers bar. In a flash, Joey put 2 of his kisses into my hand, took the 2-ounce Snickers bar, and dropped it into his bag. Joey wasn't alone in making this snap decision. All but one of the kids to whom I presented this offer traded in 2 kisses for the bigger candy bars. Zoe was the next kid to walk down the street. She was dressed as a princess in a long white dress, with a magic wand in one hand and an orange Halloween pumpkin bucket in the other. Her younger sister was resting comfortably in their father's arms, looking cute and cuddly in her bunny outfit. As they approached, Zoe called out in a high, cute voice, "Trick or treat?" In the past, I admit that I have sometimes devilishly replied, "Trick." Most kids stand there baffled, having never thought through their question to see that it allowed an alternative answer. In this case, I gave Zoe her treat, 3 Hershey's Kisses. But I did have a trick up my sleeve. I offered little Zoe a deal, a choice between getting a large Snickers bar in exchange for 1 of her Hershey's Kisses, or getting the small Snickers bar for free, without giving up any Hershey's Kisses. Now, a bit of rational calculation, which in Joey's case was amply demonstrated, would show that the best deal is to forego the free small Snickers bar, pay the cost of 1 additional Hershey's Kiss, and go for the large Snickers bar. On an ounce-for-ounce comparison, it was far better to give up 1 little Hershey's Kiss and get the larger Snickers bar, 2 ounces, instead of a smaller Snickers bar, 1 ounce. This logic was perfectly clear to Joe and the kids who encountered the condition in which both Snickers bars had a cost. But what would Zoe do? Would her clever kid's mind make that rational choice? Or would the fact that the small Snickers bar was free blind her to the rationally correct answer? As you might have guessed by now, Zoe and the other kids to whom I offered the same deal were completely blinded by free. About 70% of them gave up the better deal and took the worst deal just because it was free. Just in case you think Christina, Nina, and I make a habit of picking on kids, I'll mention that we repeated the experiment with bigger kids, in fact students at the MIT Student Center. The results replicated the pattern we saw on Halloween. Indeed, the draw of zero cost is not limited to monetary transactions. Whether it's products or money, we just can't resist the gravitational pull of free. So, do you think you have a handle on free? Okay, here's a quiz. Suppose I offered you a choice between a free $10 Amazon gift certificate and a $20 gift certificate for $7. Think quickly, which would you take? If you jumped for the free certificate, you would have been like most of the people we tested at one of the malls in Boston. But look again. A $20 gift certificate for $7 delivers a $13 profit. That's clearly better than getting a $10 certificate free, earning $10. Can you see the irrational behavior in action? We also conducted the experiment offering the $10 gift certificate for $1 and the $20 certificate for $8. This time, most of the participants jumped for the $20 certificate. Let me tell you a story that describes the real influence of free on our behavior. A few years ago, Amazon.com started offering free shipping of orders over a certain amount. Someone who purchased a single book for $16.95 might pay an additional $3.95 for shipping, for instance. But if the customer bought another book for a total of $31.90, they would get their shipping free. Some of the purchasers probably didn't want the second book. And I am talking here from personal experience. But the free shipping was so tempting that to get it, they were willing to pay the cost of the extra book. The people at Amazon were very happy with this offer, but they noticed that in one place, France, there was no increase in sales. Is the French consumer more rational than the rest of us? Unlikely. Rather, it turned out, the French